Coming up on Boston Public Radio, lawyers for Jahar Tsarnaev argue that giving him the death penalty would be unconstitutional. You agree? Death penalty opponent Alan Dershowitz says this is the wrong case to make that case. He joins us. Then Secretary of Transportation Rich Davey takes our questions and yours on aging infrastructure, Cape Flyer, apps to make your traveling life easier, and more. Then on to tattoos. Twice as many people live in a household with one than did a decade ago. We'll ask you, is the tattoo taboo history?
Kara Miller from Innovation Hub on the state of the nerd. Does nerdiness still spell social ruination or not? Then Globe columnist on two of his many obsessions, words no one has heard of but him, and a Harvard Law School professor whose confirmation as a federal judge is being held up in Washington over drone strikes in Yemen. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine are moving ahead with a referendum Sunday on the question of independence. But as NPR's Saraya Sarhadi Nelson reports from Donetsk, the region's governor says that vote is illegal.
Governor Serhiy Taruta told reporters here that it's up to Ukrainian security services to punish the separatists who carry out the unofficial referendum. But he adds voters who cast ballots will not be punished. He says they may be misguided, but are not criminals. Taruta says it's unfortunate Kiev decided not to go ahead with an official referendum on the question of more autonomy, but that giving regions more voice in the political process is something the government is working on. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Donetsk.
Rebels are claiming responsibility for a bombing in the northern Syrian city of Aleppo today. The explosion ripped through the upscale Carlton Hotel near a military base. Activists are reporting multiple casualties. The attack marks a setback for the Syrian military, which is trying to regain control of another city, Homs. Rebels have been pulling out of the central Syrian city after both sides agreed to a ceasefire last week. However, no such deal appears to be in effect in Aleppo. South Korean authorities have arrested the CEO of the company whose ferry capsized last month. The death toll from this incident is expected to near 300, with divers still recovering remains from the site of the accident near Jindo. Jason Strother has more from Seoul.
The chief of the Chunghaejin Marine Company was brought before Korean television crews upon his arrest. Kim Han-sik hasn't been charged yet, but faces allegations that he knew the Sewol ferry was not fit to sail. Prosecutors say modifications made so that the ship could carry more cargo might have led to its capsizing. 15 crew members and 4 other company officials have also been detained. Divers are still trying to recover bodies from the wreck, but South Korea's prime minister says the effort should be wrapped up during this coming weekend. But there are still a few dozen passengers unaccounted for, and there's concern that not all the bodies will be found. For NPR News, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
The search for landslide victims continues today in a remote Afghan village where as many as 2,700 people may have perished last week. Aid groups say help for displaced villagers in Badakhshan province has been slow to arrive. Part of that help is coming from Oso, Washington, site of a March landslide that killed more than 40 people. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen returned to Capitol Hill today, this time to brief members of the Senate Budget Committee on how the economy fared in the first months of 2014. She urged Congress to address the nation's long-term budget problems, saying the current course is unsustainable. Dow is up 91 points at 16,610. From Washington, this is NPR News.
And from the WGBH radio newsroom in Boston, I'm Jordan Weinstein. The Massachusetts Department of Corrections says a murder convict does not need a sex change to treat gender identity disorder. A department official told a federal appeals court today that prison officials have provided adequate treatment, including female hormones, laser hair removal, and psychotherapy. Michelle Kosilek, born as Robert Kosilek, is currently serving a life sentence for killing spouse Cheryl Kosilek in 1990. Kosilek's attorney argued that multiple doctors have said surgery is needed, and in January, a 3-judge panel of the first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a 2012 ruling saying that it is Kosilek's constitutional right to obtain treatment. A federal judge has told jurors that political patronage is not by itself a crime. The advice this morning came ahead of opening arguments in the trial of three former state probation officials accused of rigging the hiring process to fraudulently favor politically connected applicants. Health officials today are detailing their plan to overhaul Massachusetts Health Insurance Exchange website. The plan will take a dual approach, including buying software that has worked for other state systems. Governor Deval Patrick yesterday said the state does not have the time or money to build another website from scratch. The Ringling Brothers Circus resumes performances this evening in Connecticut for the first time since Sunday's accident in Providence. The resumption comes as three of the injured performers remain hospitalized at Rhode Island Hospital in serious condition. In sports, the Bruins hope to even the score tonight in Montreal against the Canadiens. It's game four of the Eastern Conference semifinals, which Montreal leads 2-1. Support for NPR comes from CSX, delivering 2.6 million containers of goods, providing essentials to move the economy forward. CSX, how tomorrow moves. 58 degrees, this is WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So you've read that lawyers for accused Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev say application of the death penalty in his case would be unconstitutional. They're citing the botched execution of Oklahoma inmate Clayton Lockett, who, as you know, died of a heart attack 43 minutes after receiving his first injection, is cruel and unusual. They also mentioned that there's an in-state ban, even though this is a federal case, against the death penalty. A new study published by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that more than 4% of death row inmates were likely innocent. Other studies note a racial bias in death penalty application. So do Tsarnaev's lawyers have a point? Is this the right case to make the case against the death penalty in the U.S.? We'll get your thoughts in a minute. But first, joining us on the phone to talk about the argument is Harvard Law School professor Alan Dershowitz. Alan's the author, most recently, of a terrific memoir. It's called Taking the Stand, My Life in Law. Alan Dershowitz, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. And, you know, if you read the memoir, you'll see that back in 1963, I was asked by Justice Arthur Goldberg, I was then his law clerk, to write a memo challenging the constitutionality of the death penalty. And that memo became kind of the beginning weapon in the fight against the death penalty that ultimately resulted in the Furman case in 1970, striking down the death penalty, which was then upheld later. So this is an ongoing process. And, you know, I've been strongly opposed to the constitutionality of the death penalty since that time, more than 50 years ago. But this is the wrong case to bring that challenge. Look, I don't blame Attorney Clark for doing it. She has one client. She has to bring it in whatever case she can. I would have done the same thing. But I think it's very unlikely that a court would pick this case to strike down the death penalty, because there are so many Americans who believe the death penalty is unconstitutional, except in terrorism cases. And this is that terrorism case. So it's going to be a long shot, even in Massachusetts.
Well, you talk about, you quote in the Herald piece this morning, when you're talking about this, that our Secretary of State, former Senator John Kerry, is in this exact same boat, being against the death penalty, except in cases of terrorism. But Professor Dershowitz, I just wonder, and obviously I am not the legal expert here, but why is the victim of a terrorist attack, why is that life deemed, almost by what you're saying, more worthy than the victim of just a run-of-the-mill murder?
I don't think it is, and I think it's a misguided argument myself. But the argument that's made, just to give the devil his due, is that terrorism is really an attack on more than a particular victim. It's an attack on a country. It's a form of treason. And it goes to the heart and soul. Look, more people are killed in automobile accidents every year than in 9/11. But we care much more when we are attacked and the national identity is attacked. So that's the argument. Certainly the life of a person killed is identical. In fact, one of the strongest arguments against the death penalty in America is that for years we never had it for the killing of black people. It was only a capital crime to kill a white person. Nobody ever got the death penalty for killing a black person. And that devaluation of black life became a very important argument in front of the Supreme Court. It didn't ultimately prevail because the court was dissatisfied with the statistical analysis. But surely if a state passed a law saying that you only get the death penalty for killing white people, that would be deemed unconstitutional. All victims' lives have to be valued identically. Of course, we don't do that when it comes to killing the president, for example, is a separate crime and carries the death penalty even in jurisdictions that don't have the death penalty for other crimes. So we do make some distinctions, but I agree with you. The argument that is made by John Kerry and others, for me, is not a satisfying argument, but it is a very commonly held view.
We're talking to Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz, if the Tsarnaev case is the wrong case, what's the right case? I mean, Clayton, the thing that got the conversation going, obviously, is this whole botched execution, as I mentioned, sure, with Clayton Lockett. Even got the president of the United States, who suggests that he is for the death penalty in limited circumstances. He said he wanted his Attorney General Eric Holder to look at this issue. But as Marjorie lays out in her column in the Herald today, Clayton Lockett and his accomplices duct taped the woman's mouth, beat her, drove her out of town, spent 20 minutes digging her grave. Then Lockett shot her twice with a sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun and buried her alive. That may end up being the case that gets to the Supreme Court, which I would argue is even less sympathetic than for the anti-death penalty advocates than is the Tsarnaev case. Why not?
Undoubtedly.
I'm sorry.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. I misunderstood. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. That would be an even worse case. Look, I think it's a mistake to be focusing also on the means of execution. It just means that the government is going to have to improve the way they kill people. We're pretty good at killing people. And we can figure out a way of a single injection of a drug that stops the heart, for example. Succinylcholine could kill somebody very, very quickly. There are many other means that can kill people quickly and painlessly. So it's a losing fight. If you think you're going to win the fight against capital punishment by focusing on botched executions, that's a short-term solution, because we'll figure out ways of killing people painlessly, effectively, instantaneously. The argument against the death penalty is essentially that there's no proof that we need it. There's no proof it does or doesn't deter. It's just that it's an equipoise. And when you have a penalty like that that is being abolished all over the world, except in the United States and half a dozen other countries, most of them countries we don't want to be in the same company with, and you can't prove it actually does have any big major impact, it's a strong argument against the use of the death penalty. But we need arguments that are pervasive, that cover everything, and that don't allow you to look at individual cases. Because what we're especially saying is that people like Tsarnaev and that man who botched execution, they deserve the worst penalty. We all agree with that. The question is, what is the worst penalty? You could argue they deserve to be tortured to death. We wouldn't do that. We wouldn't allow anybody to be tortured to death. So the question is, what's the worst penalty that a civilized society should permit? And I think many increasing numbers of Americans are saying the worst penalty you should be able to get is life imprisonment with no possibility of parole.
So how close are we? Obviously, even a conservative Supreme Court, at least the majority conservative Supreme Court, has been inching closer by carving out exceptions of the death penalty here and there. How far away are we from a Supreme Court causing us to join the rest of the Western world and no longer be ahead of places like North Korea and Libya in terms of executions? What's the case and when's it going to come?
Well, it will depend on the personnel of the Supreme Court. Look, Justice Scalia has gone so far as to say the Constitution does not prohibit the execution of an innocent man if he had a fair trial. That is, if he had a constitutionally fair trial and he turns up with his murder victim in the court and says, oh, by the way, here's the victim, he's not dead or she's not dead, Justice Scalia has suggested that he go to the governor with that, that there would be no constitutional inhibition against executing an innocent person. So, there are at least four justices who are adamantly favorable to the death penalty, a fifth who cast the deciding vote, and there's going to have to be a change of personnel before the Supreme Court strikes down the death penalty. It's going to be a hard task because the Constitution mentions the death penalty, the Fifth Amendment. Other parts of the Constitution specifically authorize it. No doubt the framers had in mind the constitutionality of the death penalty. The question is, do we have an evolving Constitution? was the choice of the word cruel and unusual punishment, which is a vague term, designed to develop a common law process by which we could change the meaning of what is cruel and what is unusual over time. That's the argument that will ultimately succeed, if any succeeds.
But we also have an evolving public opinion here, Professor Dershowitz, where more and more Americans are opposed to the death penalty. Mm-hmm. As you said before, we're one of the few civilized nations that still does executes mm-hmm. people.
Sure.
So does any of that matter to the United States Supreme Court, public opinion part?
Well, it matters to me, and it matters to some of the more liberal justices, but Scalia's answer is a very, very powerful one.
Yeah.
He says, that's great that you have changing public opinion. Abolish it by legislation. If you have enough public opinion against it, vote against it. But don't ask us judges, whose job is simply to apply the words of the Constitution and its original meaning to current events, to strike down something that the framers intended to be upheld. Win in the court of law, in the legislative chambers, not in the court of law. That's his argument. That's the argument that we have to overcome if those of us who oppose the capital punishment are going to win in the courts.
Alan Dershowitz, last thing for me. When you wrote that memo for Justice Goldberg, what did you say, 50 years ago?
Yeah.
Did Justice Goldberg say to you when he thought we'd see the permanent end of the death penalty? I know you mentioned the Furman case, but did he think we were on the cusp of getting rid of it forever?
Yes. He said in his lifetime, and that didn't happen. It did. And then it
didn't,
was
right.
Undone. So, you know, I'm 40 years younger than Justice Goldberg. I hope in my lifetime, if not in my lifetime, in your lifetime. But it's a trend that's going to succeed. It's only a question of time. And our grandchildren will look back at us and say, how could you have killed people? How could you have put people in death chambers and injected them? How do you explain that? We'll never be able to explain it to our grandchildren.
Alan Dershowitz, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was Professor Alan Dershowitz. He is from Harvard Law School. He's the author most recently, because he's written many books, of the memoir, Taking the Stand, My Life in the Law. Now we're going to ask you at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. The lawyers for Zohar Tsarnaev have argued, in part because of the botched execution of the Oklahoma killer, this Clayton Lockhart fellow, that they should look again at the death penalty in Massachusetts. They've also brought up the arguments about race, that the death penalty is unfairly applied. What do you think? Do you think that this, in Boston, this should be the case, the marathon bombing prosecution should be the case that ends the death penalty, or at least they're trying to end the death penalty once and for all in the United States of America? 877-301-8970.
They also have one other argument. Their contention is that some weight should be given to the fact, in addition to the arguments you made, that even though it is a federal trial and there is a federal death penalty, that the death penalty, if it was given to him post-conviction, is in a state that itself in state crimes and state murders has banned the death penalty. 877-301-8970. You know, it's interesting. And by the way, in addition to whether or not that this is the right case to the Supreme Court, and you have to, I think, defer to Dershowitz here, who's a pretty good appellate lawyer, and I think he's right. This is not the case, if you had to pick one, that's going to change the minds of judges. You raised the polling issue. One of the most amazing polls and surprising ones to me was in the Boston Globe in September, which was, 5 months after the marathon.
Right.
57% of people in a Globe poll, I think it was done by UNH, I'm not sure, 57 supported a life sentence for Tsarnaev. Only 33% supported the death penalty. But a few months later, in a poll by our friend David Paleologos from Suffolk, 60% this is published in the Herald, by the way, 60% supported the death penalty for Tsarnaev. So I think it's a changing thing. The most interesting poll I've ever seen, and then we'll get to your calls, on the death penalty in Massachusetts, years and years ago when Paul Cellucci was in the middle of a major push for the death penalty, and using a guy you quote in your column today, who then was for the death penalty after the grotesque murder of his son, Jeffrey Curley. Of course, I'm talking about his father, Bob Curley, as the sort of face of this whole thing. A poll was taken. Overwhelmingly, people supported the death penalty. But when they were asked the next question, if you believe life without parole meant life without parole, meaning that they weren't going to get out in 20 years or 40 years, would you support that as an alternative? And a majority of those who had supported the death penalty in the next question said yes, but they didn't believe that life without parole would ever mean life without parole. 877-301-8970. And, you know, the other arguments in this case, which don't rise to constitutional level, and we're going to hear a lot more of them from Judy Clark, who is this lawyer that's on the case purely, if he's convicted, to make sure or to work that he doesn't get the death penalty. He's a first-time offender, and as foul as it is to use that term, they are going to make that case. They are going to make the case that he was swayed by his older brother, who obviously is no longer around, to say otherwise. And while people say, well, this is ridiculous, I mean, if there's ever a case where a jury is going to come back with a death penalty, Judy Clark's record is unbelievably good. Some of the most heinous crimes committed by some of the most despicable murderers, they have not gotten the death penalty. As thanks to her counsel, they've gotten life imprisonment.
And, you know, there is one other factor that people don't like to hear about because it upsets them. But, you know, when you sit, as a jury does, for weeks and weeks and weeks, and you look at a defendant, how the defendant comes across sitting there in the docket, it matters. And he looks very young. And you never know how that's going to play with the jurors, that he's 20 years old.
Yeah, I agree.
He's a slight person. You know, you never know. I mean, I certainly think a lot of people talked in many notorious cases. For example, the O.J. Simpson case, how after looking at O.J. Simpson every single solitary day, more and more people on the jury pool began to feel empathy, incredibly, for O.J. Simpson.
And by the way, good defense lawyers, I know if you watch television, you know this, you don't have to hear it from me, counsel their clients always in criminal cases and in civil cases about how to act, who to look at,
oh, yes,
who not to look at. All those kinds of things.
You know, just a very quick story before we take the calls. I remember covering a trial of the so-called Harvard rape docs many years ago. They were these three doctors that were accused of raping a nurse and convicted, by the way. One of them was tried a second time for sexually assaulting a patient in the hospital. And the defense lawyer, very brilliantly, I thought, made a big show every day of walking in the doctor's beautiful wife so that the jury could all see who she was. And, of course, why was he doing that? Because he was trying to implant doubt in their mind, saying, why would he rape this older, elderly patient when he had this beautiful wife?
Without ever having to say it.
Yes. Nothing to do with the right or wrong of the case. And you know what? He was acquitted.
Let's take some calls. Pat, you're on the Turnpike. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi there, Pat.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good, thank you.
Hey, I wanted to call in about, on a cultural level, why we might never get rid of the death penalty. I think ever since we set up this this culture of a fearful society that we live in right now, everybody's afraid. Everybody thinks there's death around the next corner, or we're going to have our children snatched, or, you know, anything like that. We're constantly living in a state of fear. And our prison population is through the roof. We lead the world in the prison population, you know, and there's no reason to believe that we're going to back off on the death penalty, because we live in a punitive culture. We are victims, and we are afraid of everything. And we want justice. We want people to be punished, so we don't have to be afraid anymore. I just think that's part of the thing that's operating. Ever since we started this thing in the 80s where everything's scary, you know, it leads on the news.
Yeah, but let me just say a couple things first.
I think, John, you make a brilliant point. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was John. Pat, I think you make a brilliant point. We've changed the way we raise children based on fear that they're going to be abducted. Thank God it almost never, ever happens that they're abducted by strangers. Things happen within families usually. But we've changed everything because of that fear.
By the way, I would guess, Pat, that when you said we have more people in prison than any country in the world, my guess is, I don't know this in front of me, my guess is China may have more people in prison than we do.
We don't know because they don't release the numbers.
But I think one of the reasons why we still have the death penalty and we're the outlier is it's about leadership. I mean, we've discussed this in the last couple of weeks, and thanks for the call, Pat. I assume, and I think you agree with this, that Barack Obama does not support the death penalty, but figured, I can't get elected president of the United States, just like John Kerry thought he couldn't get elected president of the United States if he opposed the Iraq War, even though it's pretty clear to me he did, but was told by his, what's the guy's name, Shrum, who was 0-7
Shrum,
in presidential campaigns,
Democratic strategist,
that you probably have to support the Iraq War. If there was a leader who was deeply respected, a senator, for example, who was on a crusade against the death penalty, an unlikely senator, a conservative Republican senator, for example, who led the charge, I think the whole debate in this country would be different. It's sort of like medical marijuana. There's still people who say, and I'm not equating the two, there's still elected leaders who are too nervous to say, medical marijuana is okay. You can prescribe OxyContin, but you can't prescribe medical marijuana because they're worried about the backlash. Same with the death penalty. It's essentially an issue in search of a leader.
Well, it's also fascinating that up in New Hampshire, we have Jean Shaheen running against Scott Brown. Jean Shaheen is a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat, is in favor of the death penalty.
I know that.
And people cite that as a reason. Well, you know, she's middle of the road. She's not one of those soft-on-crime Democrats. The Democrats are viewed as soft-on-crime. The Republicans are not. I think Democrats often go out of their way to establish their tough-on-crime bona fides. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Paula in the car. Hi, Paula.
Hello, Paula.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. Thank you for the call.
So I'm kind of responding to the Dr. Dershowitz or Professor?
Professor.
What, Professor?
I guess he's both, actually.
Alan Dershowitz. Go ahead.
So he had mentioned, what do we say to our grandchildren that we've put people in gas chambers and basically euthanized them by a lethal injection? Well, how do you justify what they did to another victim? I mean, they didn't humanely kill them. They've maimed, tortured, murdered. So...
Well, let me speak for Alan Dershowitz and myself in this case. I don't think anybody's justifying what they do, what any of these, especially Clayton Lockett and Jahar Tsarnaev allegedly has done. He hasn't been convicted yet. I don't think it's a justification. I think the question is, should the state be executing human beings, or should the ultimate punishment be life in prison without parole? And Paula, if you're one who believes, and I've said this a lot, and by the way, this is the Bill O'Reilly argument. It's a rare moment where I think people who are opposed to the death penalty who are liberals embrace Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly's opposition is because he thinks far harsher punishment is life in prison without parole. You get an injection, you're gone in 30 seconds if they don't botch it. If you're in prison without parole, you got to sit in a box for 40, 50, or in the case of Tsarnaev, maybe 60 or 70 years, realizing you'll never be free.
The Frontline documentary about solitary confinement, what that means, I mean, it is hell on earth. You'd be much better off dead than being in the solitary confinement from what I've seen.
So, Paula, no one's justifying the underlying... I mean, no one is saying the underlying crime, especially in these two cases, is anything but as bad as it gets.
Okay.
Oh, we're also paying as taxpayers, paying for their life to exist, whereas that victim didn't have the choice.
That's true. I think
you end up paying in many situations, though, more money in legal fees when you're trying to kill somebody, Paula, because it's so expensive and these appeals go on for years and years and years. This Clayton Lockett murdered this woman in 1999. It's now 15 years later.
It's been proven that it is more expensive on average to execute someone
than it is to keep you in jail for a long time.
But, Paula, thank you for the call. But, Paula, I mean, the emotional point that Paula is making is, I think, the point that it's sort of an eye for an eye kind of notion.
Yes.
They took away the life of John Doe or Jane Doe, why should they be able to live? And the question is, what kind of society do you have? Virtually every Western nation, and I would argue most of them are not soft on crime, particularly on killers, virtually every Western nation has banned the death penalty. And so you ask, why have they banned it, and why are we the outlier?
Well, I think we have this big political, I mean, we have this cowboy macho thing going on in the United States a lot of times that winds us up in these bad situations, if you ask me. 877-301-8970. We're talking about the death penalty today, which could be meted out in the case of Jahar Tsarnaev, the alleged marathon bomber. Let's go to John on 295. Hi, John.
Hello, John.
Hi, guys. My name's Joffrey, actually.
Joffrey.
You know, but I just like to say that, you know, we live in a society where I think we believe that the punishment should fit the crime. You know what I mean? And I feel like when we throw away the death sentence, like for people who murder other people, we're like cheapening the lives of the victim. Like we're saying, like, you know, they don't deserve the justice that we give, you know, proportionality is what I'm trying to argue. And I think at the same time, the community is so hungry for like Tsarnaev, like that it's kind of like sickening in a sense. You know what I mean? Like, obviously, like he did this terrible crime. You know what I mean? He should be punished for it. But like everybody's turning into this like, I want that guy to know. Like if I see him in the street, you know, like they want to, you know, they turn into this like, this is not what we're about. It's about justice. You know what I mean? And I think that to argue against the point Jim made earlier, that life sentences could be a cruel and unusual punishment because a lot of mental like problems can occur inside prisons. You know what I mean? And
that's, I think that's like, a decent point, Joffrey. But did you read Marjorie's column this morning yet on this issue?
No, I've been driving all morning.
Okay. Marjorie makes a point. Let me characterize an argument she makes, which I think is, in terms of your concern, which I admire, and it is a very important one, and the prior callers too, about the family, the people who love the person that was executed by the killer who has been convicted by the state. You're sent to life in prison without parole. It's as over as it can be, and it's obviously never over, but at least it's over. Here, as Marjorie wrote, 15 years after Lockett committed this most abominable crime, his family's got to live through the murder all over again, and I'm sure did every single time there was an appeal that was denied and denied and denied, and now they're reliving it again, and
but
they're probably
going to
relive it for years as this Lockett execution provokes this national debate.
That's it. They're having
Joffrey,
listen to the name of their child's killer as the supposed martyr.
Cause celeb, right.
Exactly, the cause celeb that could overturn the death penalty in the United States of America. That's really kind of sickening. And also the research on the death penalty, you know, you look at the families, the survivors of these terrible crimes, the parents and sisters. Ironically, or not ironically, I suppose, but paradoxically, the death penalty doesn't give the satisfaction that people are hoping for or the so-called closure.
Closure, the worst word in the English language.
For. It's sort of a Peggy Lee, is that all there is? And it doesn't help the families in the way that many people expect it's going to. Anyway, we are moving on from this right now because we are going to be joined by in just a second by Rich Davey. He's the secretary and CEO of the Mass Department of Transportation. He's going to take all our questions and yours about T's and buses and traffic and new construction. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, the years between 18 and 21 can be hard. Harder still if you're dealing with mental health issues. If you miss this on the radio, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
Here in New England, many employers offer matching gift programs. So your gift to WGBH could be doubled or even tripled without your spending another dime. Learn more at WGBH.org/matching gifts.
Support for WGBH comes from you and the Museum of Science, where you can see over 2,000 species of sea life, introducing Journey to the South Pacific, a new IMAX film that takes you to the most diverse ecosystem on Earth. More at mos.org/South Pacific. And Xconomy.com, presenting Boston 2034 on June 10th, exploring the ideas, innovators, and companies poised to drive the economy in the years to come. More at Xconomy.com/Boston 2034.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Ginn. Here with us in Studio 3 to take our questions and yours is the CEO and Secretary of the Mass Department of Transportation, otherwise known as MassDOT. That would be Rich Davey. Rich, good to see you.
Thank you again for having me. Appreciate it.
Now, if you see something, say something, as the saying goes. Our phone number, which will get you directly in touch with Secretary Davey, is 877-301-8970. Or you can email him a question at bprwgbh.org, or you can tweet him a question at BOS Public Radio.
Yeah, and I just want to say we've got a million questions in the email here already for the secretary, so we're going to have to get them to your office. We'll never get through them all.
Absolutely.
But I want to begin with some apparent breaking news of hooligans on the in the HOV lane. What's going on?
It's shocking. Shocking. State police today pulled over a customer in our HOV lane. And HOV, by the way, means high occupancy vehicle.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't mean that you can have a mannequin head propped up in the passenger seat, which this customer apparently had. And so state police pulled him over and ticketed them, of course. So I think there's a picture on Mass State Police Facebook and website. It's a quite good-looking mannequin, by the way.
Really? Man or woman?
Man, a mustache, some nice eyebrows, but didn't pass muster. So.
Wow. So they
HOV
can see
for
it.
Real people only.
It could see, you know, when my kids were little, I used to make sure I propped them up high enough in the car seat so that they would look like real people. I get through the HOV lane. But he identified this, so it couldn't have been that good.
Apparently it was not that good. And this trooper's actually got a good eye. He did this last year, too, found someone who put a doll in a – unlike you, Marjorie, you actually had your children in a car
right.
seat. Apparently someone last year put a doll. So, again – you know, real people only in the HOV lane.
By the way, let me just clarify this. Marjorie had her children recently in the car seat. The only problem is they're all in their 20s. So we can leave it there, but that must have been one big car seat.
She was hoping
seat.
For a toll discount or something. I don't know what.
So before we get to calls and emails, mm-hmm. et cetera, I was stunned to learn that Mother's Day, the heavy is huge in terms of traffic. It's ranked second only to the Friday before Columbus Day.
Yeah. So I mean,
this weekend.
Yes. So you know, a couple of things. One, I think people think Thanksgiving is always the busiest travel day of the year. It's not true. As you said, Columbus Day and Mother's Day. So I think you know for a few reasons. Not only because everyone's visiting their mom, and I think my mom's listening. So I'll see you Sunday, Mom. You know, folks are traveling, obviously. It's usually one of the most beautiful weekends. You know, we're coming out of winter, and a lot of folks are running down the Cape as well to their Cape homes for a little early summer. So, yes, please plan ahead, travel. You know, use our travel advisories. We have a new app.
Yeah, what's the new app? I love this. What's this new app?
So the new app is called RideWise, which you can download on your phone. It gives you real-time traffic information on a number of roads, 93, obviously Route 6, Route 3, Route 90, a few other places around the state, and you can get real-time information about what traffic holds. You know, the bridges over the Cape Cod Canal have always been a challenge. 2 years ago, they were a significant challenge. But we're working with the Army Corps of Engineers who actually own those bridges and take care of them. They should be they have work now. They'll stop by noon tomorrow to get out of the way. So we're taking a lot of precautions to make sure folks travel this weekend is good. But remember, as you said, Margie, it's the second busiest travel day
of the year. I had no idea. And also the Cape Flyer, the train that goes between Boston and the Cape, that's not running yet, is it?
Not running yet. We'll start that Friday of Memorial Day weekend, so May 23rd. Okay. It was a great hit last year. People are really excited. The trip's going to be shorter this year because we're actually reducing the number of stops. You'll get to Boston and Hyannis in about 2 hours. Probably 15 minutes with a bar car in there. So it's a nice way to travel down the Cape.
Before we move on, I would take calls, and we have more questions for you too, Rich Davey. I think I asked you this a year ago. One of the mysteries of transportation I will never understand is why are there still so many holdouts on Easy Pass? When you get, for example, the Weston tolls or whatever it is, mm-hmm. if you have Easy Pass, as some of us do, like Marjorie and I do, you get through in about 3.5 seconds for the most part. And there are people in lines that may have 100 cars. And what is this? They're worried that you're going to go to their house and look in their window when you... I'm serious. Yeah. What is the holdout still?
I don't know because...
What percentage, by the way, do not have Easy Pass?
So it's probably, for all transactions across the state, about 35%.
That is pathetic.
The Tobin is the best. It's about 70% Easy Pass, 30% non-Easy
Pass. And I assume you've surveyed or you have some... What is the holdout? What's the reason?
I think it's a few things. I think it's just reluctance to change. Although, you know, folks should know, Easy Passes are free in Massachusetts. A lot of states charge. We do not. And we now have a roving van that goes out on weekends to, you know, shopping plazas and grocery stores to get more people signed up. And we've seen an uptick in that. I mean, look, there are those others who are concerned about, to your point, moving, you know, people following them or moving.
The government spying
on
them.
Here's the bottom line. If any of you have a cell phone listening right now, which I'm sure all of you do, the Bluetooth technology in your phone is by far the easiest way for anyone to follow you. So we're not sitting at a home at night. I'm not scanning my computer to see, you know, who's Easy Pass one here or there.
So you're saying if people want to be intellectually honest and don't have Easy Pass, they should throw away their cell phones. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
That is what you're saying.
Consistency is important. Although I have to say, I found out my godmother last year didn't have one. And after yelling at her at the Thanksgiving table, I had her signed up immediately. So I think part of it's just, you know, taking the time. It's very easy to do. And by the way, in the future, you know, we're getting rid of the toll booths. It's going to be all electronic tolling. In the future, we're going to be taking pictures of people's license plates and send them a bill. And I wouldn't be surprised, folks, in the future, if you go to that kind of method, we'll probably charge you more. Easy Pass would get a discount and folks
That's
would
open
not.
Road tolling, where you don't even have to slow down, right?
That's right. 65 miles an hour or whatever the
when
road.
When does that happen?
We'll be on the Tobin Bridge the weekend after July 4th.
Ooh.
And we will be out the rest of the state in the next 2 years.
Fabulous. One last thing before we get to the calls. Obviously, everybody was excited. I think virtually everybody was excited about late night weekend tea service. What's the word on the first, 4 or 5 weeks of this?
Yeah, so about 5 weeks. You know, the governor made it a key priority for us to get done this year. We've had over 100,000 customers use the system. And we're actually starting to see some events come around this now. So restaurants are looking at later night service opportunities. One person told me they're going to try to go to the MFA and see if the MFA or the ICA would actually have the museum open till 1, 2 in the morning. Mm. So folks are really trying to think about, you know, how to use the tea. And we've actually talked to some folks about using the tea itself as a opportunity. I'll give you a quick example, a little crazy, but about 3 years ago, 4 years ago in New York, there was literally a pop-up restaurant on the subway system, and it was sort of underground. You got on, and every three stations, someone brought on a new course, gourmet food. I mean, you know, kind of crazy. We're going to look at doing.
Do you know who Michael Norton is?
I do. Yes,
the from Harvard Business School. Yeah. He was here yesterday. He wrote a piece in the New York Times, citing research that suggested, demonstrated that when people get on a subway and talk to other people, yeah. which is anathema to some right. of us. Not only is the talker happier at the end of the interaction, but the person with whom you started the conversation is happier. So is a, I don't know, a Love Thy Stranger campaign in the future? Do you encourage sure. people to talk to, I'm serious about this,
yeah.
or to keep to themselves?
No, I mean, certainly the interaction in the subway is fantastic. But in you know my anecdotal experience, most folks are either listening to or playing with you know their iPhone or other device. And that's 70% of the time as I've looked around. You know, but at the same time, people recognize me from time to time, and I'm happy to engage in conversation with folks. So, yeah, I think we could probably be a little less in our cocoon and actually interact with human beings. It's probably good for all of us.
Let's take a couple of calls.
Sure.
Rich Davey is the Secretary of Transportation for the state of Massachusetts. Marjorie, take it away.
Let's go to Lisa from Maynard. Hi, Lisa.
Hello, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My main question is, when I'm in the city and I need to get somewhere, say, to work or to a professional engagement, I feel that I really can't rely on the T to get me there on time. I have to leave, you know, plenty of extra time. I'd always get there faster in my car. And I'm wondering if there's something that can be done to make the system more reliable so that
sure.
the train breaks down, there's something that can get me to where I'm going on time.
Sure. No, I mean, it's a great question, Lisa, and I appreciate the call. So I assume for Maynard, you're driving in, parking, and then if you need to get, you know, around town, you're either jumping on the T. Obviously, the bike share program that we rolled out with the city a couple of years ago is another strategy to get around town quite seamlessly. But look, back to the question of reliability. Red Line, we're running cars that were built in 1969. Every Orange Line car was built in 1979, for example. These things, we should have had a retirement party for them, you know, 10 years ago. The good news is we are buying both all new Orange Line cars and 75 new Red Line cars. That's the number one improvement we can make for reliability, for sure. And actually, next week, we're going to be buying 24 new Green Line trains to not only accommodate the Green Line extension, but also to begin to run some of those now. That's the number one piece we can do on the subway to have improved reliability. I hope the countdown clocks at the subways have helped as well. Reduce your anxiety when you're at a
station.
Explain
what that is, Rich.
Yeah,
please.
So as opposed to the old method of leaning your neck over the subway line and seeing if there was a headlight coming, we are now providing real-time information for both the subway system and all of our buses, by the way. So again, you know, if we're having an issue, you should be able to know about it and then make another decision. But we're working hard. Reliability actually was better in 2013 than 2012 because we've made some maintenance investments, but the new cars will definitely help.
Lisa, thank you very much for the call. On that note, the governor, your boss, was on television with me a couple of weeks ago, and I said, so you're only a few months away from the end of your term. What's your greatest frustration? Something that's not going to get accomplished.
Other than Rich Davey?
well, actually, it relates to you. And he said, I don't really want to get into that. And I asked him again. He said, okay, one thing. The inadequacy, I'm putting words mm-hmm. in his mouth, but
sure.
this was just inadequacy of long-term investment in the infrastructure
yeah.
of transportation. I know you guys were looking for a ton of money last year. You didn't get quite as much. What people like me, I think, worry about, when you see all these horrific stories of old gas lines
yeah.
exploding and then people dying in fires, or water mains in New York City that are 100 years old like yeah. they are in downtown Boston, are we going to reach a point where it all falls apart, as the saying. I'm serious, but I know you're making a huge amount
yeah.
of investment. You just listed it. But is that not something that haunts you, and shouldn't it haunt us?
Well, look, I mean, if there are safety issues out there that we know about, those are our number one priorities to address. But I think you're right, Jim. I mean, look, I didn't appreciate personally, just as a, you know, Joe Q citizen, what the MWRA, the Massachusetts Water Resource Authority, did until that pipe broke 3 years ago and I had to boil my own water for 3 days.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, I think to get folks' attention, it takes an emergency, maybe a tragedy, or certainly a big inconvenience like that. You know, the Minnesota Bridge collapsed back in 2007, the I-35 Minnesota Bridge collapsed, killed.
And the people went into the water.
Yeah, and there were dozens of people killed. The federal government responded by doing nothing. You know, the governor and the legislature stepped up with a number of bridge investments that we've been able to make. The same is true with some of the train accidents we've seen recently, not here in Massachusetts, but in other places. And I think at the federal level, There was an article in the Globe, Noah Bierman wrote at the national level. That's what I worry about the most. I think the state is focused on it, but at the federal level, I don't know what they're focused on.
Billions of dollars held up, correct?
Possibly.
So and Joe wants to know, he just emailed, if that means the Green Line extension will not be done because of this concern about federal money.
Yeah, no, it's a good question.
Or the widening of 128.
Is it Joe Curtatone? Is that who? the mayor of Somerville? Exactly.
Oh, not the mayor of Somerville.
No. So, Joe, I mean, the answer is we have both, we're going for a federal grant to get half of the cost of the project. If the federal government is unable to fund it, we're legally obligated to build the Green Line extension, period. It's a big mitigation, blah, blah, blah. But we're required to do it. We'll have to cut other things is the bottom line, Joe. We'll do the Green Line extension, but we might not do, you know, five bridges, for example, that Jim was sort of suggesting. So it would be a very painful cut for us if we had to use more money on the Green Line extension, which is a great project, by the way. But that we would have to cut other things.
One last thing on that. What's the one project that most worries you that is not in the proverbial pipeline that you're concerned there may not be enough money for, either because of the lack of investment by the state or because of the holdup of federal funds? Is there one that keeps you sleepless or quasi-sleepless at night?
You know, there's nothing that keeps me sleepless because we have enough money to, as I said, either literally fix a bridge or, I mean, we have 45 bridges in the state that are closed right now that don't have high volumes of traffic, so we can do that. But so if we're doing everything we can to make sure, you know, the highway industry are able to sleep at night, we absolutely wouldn't allow folks to go over that. But look, there's a lot of good projects in the future. Expansion of South Station, for example, potentially running more train service in Springfield. These things aren't going to happen unless the federal government steps up and funds transportation, which it seems to me you can argue about. I know you're talking about death penalty and health care, and I think there's a lot of places you can have a civilized debate about government's role. But, you know, since the country was founded, we've pretty much made it clear that transportation is part of our social compact and we should be funding it as a society.
You know, just one more money question, then we'll be quiet and get back to the phone calls and the emails. People probably know that there's a gas tax ballot question, defeating the gas tax ballot question. It's probably going to be on the ballot before voters in November.
Defeating the inflation adjustment to the gas tax,
correct.
Right, not
and
the gas tax increase.
The group
itself.
That's behind this repeal wants an ethics probe of transportation officials. That would include you because they say you've used taxpayers-funded resources for political purposes by sending out an email, talking points email, declaring your intention to push to defeat the ballot question. So are you advocating for a no vote on the gas tax repeal?
Absolutely.
Secretary?
I mean, that's my job.
Okay.
And we pushed the bill that was passed to allow for the inflationary index. And both the ethics laws and the Office of Campaign Finance, more mumbo jumbo, are very clear that if it's something within a secretary's expertise, it's exactly – now, I shouldn't be talking about, you know, medical marijuana or the death penalty if that's on the ballot. That's not my job. But certainly as transportation secretary, I can talk about that. And with all due respect to those who brought these ethics charges up – by the way, I think it's ironic. The guy who brought it up, the state rep, actually violated the same ethics law 3 years ago. So I'm not sure I'm going to take a lot of lessons from him.
Who's this, Jeff Deal?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
What did he do?
He sent home fundraising material through his daughter's third grade class or something, offering to read the children, I think, Paul Revere's Ride, but the parents had to donate to his campaign. So in any event...
I'm glad you're not going to mention
exactly.
that.
Exactly. But I'm not going to mention that. No, I'm kidding.
Okay.
But with all due respect, I've sent the letter, you know, to ethics and say, here's our perspective. You know, tell me if we're right or wrong. I'm very confident we're right.
Julia has tweeted the following question to you, Secretary Davey. Why is Park Street the only place to transfer value to the Charlie card? I've had money on my Charlie ticket and an expired card for years. What's the answer to that question?
So the question is, she's using an expired card, which
I don't know.
Money.
I'm just reading it verbatim. Why is Park Street the only place to transfer value to the Charlie card? Is that true?
No, I'm not sure that is.
Julia, retweet us because I'm not totally
clear.
Or tweet
me. Tweet me.
What's
at MassDOT.
Your Twitter?
It's at MassDOT, and I'll have someone get back to you. And if there's a problem, we'll fix it.
And reference the fact that you tweeted on the show, Julia. Let's go to Betty. You're in Rockland. You're on with Rich Davey, the Secretary of Transportation. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about potholes.
Sure.
I understand the legislature has allocated money to fix them. And I'd like to know, why is that money that's been dedicated for that being held back? wouldn't that be considered dishonest to hold that money back?
So a couple things, Betty. First of all, actually, the administration proposed the pothole program. It's a $30 million program, and every city and town in Massachusetts will get the money. It's not being held back at all. There has to be obligated. We have to have a contract signed with each city and town by June 30th, and it has to be spent by September 30th, I believe. So that is not being held back at all.
Well, that was an abrupt end to that sentence. But Betty, thank you for the call. Bob, you're in Harwich. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Rich Davey. Hi there, Bob.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to preface my question by saying I'm 70 years old. I'm retired. I'm on Social Security. My COLA increase is maybe 1.3 a year. It does not take in consideration the tax on gas or food. I mean, there was a time we paid $1.50 for a gallon of gas, maybe 99 cents for a pound of grapes. Now, I'm sure I'm not the only 70-year-old person listening to this, but if you have that automatic gas tax increase tied to inflation, I can't accept that. But how many fees and taxes has the Deval administration tried to pass since he's been in office? Could you tell me?
Well, Bob, I can certainly talk about transportation fees and finances. And let me give you just some perspective. Last year we took in $600 million of the gas tax. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation has over $1 billion in debt. It means we're paying off things that were bought, built, or serviced over the last couple of decades. I mean, that's just the reality. And, you know, I get it. People don't like to pay more. I don't like to pay more. But I guess my challenge back to you is, then how do we pay for these things? Because I don't think we were honest with the public over the last couple of decades about what things cost. We're trying to – and the beauty about, I think, the gas tax is that it is constitutionally protected and goes to transportation. So I think for you, Bob, in the future, whether it's our administration or the next one, the legislature, you know, they really can't play with that money. They can't fund a different project or something else within the budget, which is why the gas tax, I think, in many respects, is the most transparent kind of fee that can pay for transportation. But obviously, you know, people disagree you know, maybe we'll disagree, but I think it's the best way to go.
Bob, thank you for the call.
Let's go to George in Jamaica Plain. Hi, George.
Hello, George.
Hello, it's George, the swan boat dad.
Oh, hi, George. How are you?
I'm fine, and he's running the swan boat today. It's a beautiful day.
Beautiful day.
Secretary Davey, I'm really excited about Track 61, which I don't think much in Drim know about.
What is it?
That's the service from Back Bay to the convention center.
Ah, yes. Okay.
I read, like last year, that your department was working on it. It was going to be on a fast track, and then I haven't heard anything since.
Sure. So a couple things, George. First of all, briefly, as you mentioned, this Track 61 service would literally be able to run subway-like service on our commuter rail line between the Back Bay station, i.e. where all the hotels are, and get folks on to get to the convention center. So we get cabs and buses off the street, which would be great for traffic. So we've been talking with the one manufacturer of these cars here in the United States. And so we're still negotiating with them to see if we can buy cars from them. If not, we'll put out a procurement. But we're very, very focused on getting that done. We've worked closely with the convention center folks. Jim Rooney, who runs it, he's also very interested in it. You know, I think folks probably know he wants to expand the convention center, and this could actually help move people seamlessly and not have traffic happen. Again, you know, if the gas tax question passes, though, that might be one of the things that's on the chopping block. So, but we want to get it done and certainly get it done before this administration leaves.
George, thanks for the call. Can we talk about Keolis for a minute?
Sure.
Keolis is the French company to which you awarded a close to a $3 billion commuter rail contract. And it's been in the news primarily because of what some are suggesting was a shakedown by a bunch of black ministers, one of them who presented a bill for $105,000 in invoice, and that was Gene Rivers, who used to be a regular on our show. And it was signed by Bruce Wohl, another minister. Marjorie asked your boss about this on our show a little while ago, and it led Joan Vinanke in The Globe to write a column saying Patrick's quiet and disquieting response to the Keola shakedown, essentially saying it's not typical, it's not a big deal. I asked Beverly Scott, head of the T, are you guys doing any investigation? Because I'll give you one example. In the Globe reporting, Bruce Wohl, who signed this thing, used to be a fierce opponent of Keolis getting the contract. And lo and behold, he apparently has an epiphany.
Right.
And he comes to a meeting and he's a big supporter. And as I said to Beverly Scott, it seems something happened in between that don't you want to know about? We're not, I'm paraphrasing what you said, we're not doing an investigation. We're not doing anything there. If you're not, and I don't know if you're, I assume what she says applies to you too, why aren't you interested in what went on behind the scenes that led to what may be illegal conduct by a major contractor for the Transportation Department?
Yeah, so for the record, I've been recused from this entire process because I was formerly the general manager of NBCR, who was another
bidder.
Which is
the other, who had the contract.
That's right. And so I purposefully, when I came into state government 4 years ago, said I'm not going to have any role in this. Just, you know, let the chips fall where they may and have a competitive process. So with that, though, I think if there's any criminal activity, there are certainly – I mean, we don't investigate criminal activity as a general matter. It would be referred to any number of state agencies to be reviewed. But certainly if there's any allegations of untoward activity by any of our contractors, we're going to be interested in that for sure.
But you're not – but just again, I understand the criminal – first of all, is there a criminal investigation as far as you know?
I don't know that.
Aren't you – when you – what is the adjective you use? Curious activity? What did you just say? What was the word?
Untoward activity.
Untoward. Mm-hmm. Do you not – is it not potentially untoward that a critical high-profile opponent overnight becomes a critical high-profile supporter? Is there not – aren't there issues that are raised? That-
oh, I certainly smells. There's no doubt about it. But, I mean, a couple things here. One, it did not influence the team's decision or the board's decision one iota. So I think that's what both the transition team and our board would be concerned about. If it was part of that, I absolutely would – we would be launching an investigation if there was any kind of, you know, putting the finger on the scale for the procurement. It was pretty easy, as I understand it, to make the decision because – Keolis was so much cheaper than NBCR. But look, I think, you know, we have to keep certainly an eye on this. If there are subcontractors, contractors who are being asked to do anything, yeah, we will have investigation rights under the contract with Keolis. That's not in effect right now. It becomes effective as of July.
But as of now, this whole invoice thing from the group of black ministers is off the table for you guys. I'm just trying to be
I think so, Jim. Yeah, okay. I mean, if something else came up, let me look. It doesn't smell right at all. I'm not sure that it rises to the level of an investigation within the DOT. I don't know if it's been referred to others for criminal investigation, but I also think too that certainly transparency is probably the best disinfectant because I know folks are on the defensive who provided this invoice, and you know at the end of the day there are a lot of other ways we can make sure there's diversification at the commuter rail than that kind of nonsense. And we'll be all over the contractor to make sure that they're giving opportunities, business opportunities and employment opportunities otherwise, without having to go through that kind of, process of having folks get paid for I'm not sure what.
That's the voice of Rich Davey. He's the Secretary of Transportation. We try to squeeze in another call or two.
Let's go to Alan in Jamaica Plain. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Alan.
Howdy, Alan.
Secretary
Davey, this is Alan. We've been in meetings about the big bus yard that you're planning in Forest Hills.
Yes.
And I'm sure you remember it.
Of course I do. And I remember you.
Yep, great. Thank you. And just for everybody, Forest Hills, this was proposed 15 years ago originally, and the Forest Hills area has changed significantly. And we got great residential neighborhoods in the four parks, and we have 1,000 new units of housing on the way. And we got the Forest Hills Station, the major transit hub, and you're taking down MassDOT, you're taking down the Casey Overpass. Mm-hmm. You're going to replace that with a section of the Emerald Necklace. And part of this, and taking that down, you promised is blossoming of Forest Hills. And now we're looking at you spending the first installment of $30 million on a $250 million bus garage in the middle of all this wonderfulness. And it just seems like the bus garage in that location, it's just really colossally bad urban planning. And I'm wondering about, MassDOT has its Green Dot program for green, environmentally sound building. And one, there's a possible location, as you know, down the road, and we'd just like a moratorium on any expenditures at this site and engage with the community and the city and, real master planning.
We got it. Alan, we've got it. We're a little short on time. If you can, just let the secretary respond.
Alan also has my email. We email –
What is your, by the way, you have people, you respond to direct email to you. What is your email?
Richard.Davey@state.ma.us.
Okay.
By the way, I've only had one person as a result of being on the show to ever email me.
Is that true?
Now I'm going to have
that
a
was
whole
me,
cascade.
I think it was.
It was you, exactly.
We have a lot of people emailing
Jim
today.
B,
a lot of complainers, by the way. Complaining about a set of things.
And we'll forward all these. But yeah, is that, is that the end of the Alan discussion?
So for Alan, quickly, Alan, you're right. We have a lot going on in Forest Hills. I think, you know, you and I have talked. People love bus service. They don't like bus garages, right? So we have to be able to find a way to build this new garage. And just so as folks know, we're moving the place where the buses are now so there can be significant development in Forest Hills. We're going to still look at it for sure. And you and I will talk off air for sure.
Alan, thanks. Hey, before you go, and by the way, everybody on the line, if you stay on hold, we will take your phone number. We'll forward it to the Secretary's office.
We'll get back to you.
If you've emailed, Marjorie says there are a ton, or tweets, we'll forward all of those as well. So you will get a response. The Lenny Zakin Bridge is going to be purple.
Yes.
This weekend for a cause that's near and dear to Marjorie and my heart. Can you tell us why it's going to be purple,
Rich
Davey?
Sure, sure. So it's the Mother's Day Walk for Peace, which is happening on Mother's Day. And I think it was founded almost 20 years ago as a way to, you know, have parents, mothers in particular, I think have a moment to remember children who were killed through violent acts. And, you know, we partnered with Joyce Zakin and Philips Lighting a few years ago to improve the lighting at the Zakin Bridge. And what we do from time to time is light the bridge in honor of a charity, much like the Prue does, Prudential mm-hmm. Building does around Christmas time. And it's a great way for us to help promote, you know, good causes. So it will be purple on Sunday on behalf of the Mother's Day Walk for Peace, which is a great, as I say, great time, great organization. I'm glad you guys both support
it. And by the way, it's Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute. If you want to participate in the walk, and there are thousands of people, and they're not just there to celebrate the lives of people who have been taken away by violence, but also to talk about their peace agenda.
That's right.
It's Mother's Day Walk 4, the number 4, peace.org. It's Sunday. LaToya Edwards and I are emceeing this thing.
Cool.
Marjorie and I have in the past. It's a great event.
Thank you very much.
It's great to see you, Rich Davey.
Anytime.
Rich Davey is the Secretary and CEO of the Mass Department of Transportation. Up next. By the way, you don't have any tattoos, do you, Secretary Davey?
Not as far as you know, Marjorie.
Okay. Okay.
How's that?
Because up next, we're going to talk about that.
A new
poll says...
My tattoos or someone else's tattoos? Sorry.
If you'd like to confess your tattoos...
Actually, stay here 30 more seconds.
Yeah.
One of the issues we're going to... The number of people who say that they have tattooed person in their household has doubled in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
We're going to ask people if it's now mainstreamed. If you were about to hire an executive and he had or she had a tattoo on their face... Or
face.
On their, or their neck, or their hand, an exposed tattoo. Would it make it less likely you'd hire them?
Probably. I probably would.
There
and
you go.
I bet on the 50% more, or double the number. I wonder how many people are actually having tattoos removed, too.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure
great
that
question.
Is also...
That's why I keep telling my daughter. Mm-hmm. She doesn't listen to me at
hey,
all.
Hey, thank you, Rich Davey. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about tattoos up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Police routinely encounter people with mental illness. That can mean having to deal with delusional suspects.
It's incredibly difficult to get someone who believes they have an assignment from the FBI to really admit that they don't, and they do need help, and it's time to go and talk to somebody at the hospital.
Training police to deal with mental health issues. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you. And Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LaheyHealth.org. That's LaheyHealth.org. And Seasons 4, for 44 years, the Outdoor Living Store on Mass Ave in Lexington, featuring a wide selection of contemporary and traditional outdoor furniture, plus a large selection of plants, statuary, and garden accessories. Seasons4.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A new NBC Wall Street Journal poll says 40% of U.S. households, Marjorie, have somebody who's got a tattoo. In 1999, 15 years ago, only 21% of households had someone with ink. Why the sudden explosion in tattoos? We want to know at 877-301-8970, or if you are part of that 40%, if you have an embarrassing one, you can tell us about that too. Are people louder and prouder about getting work done now on their bodies? And have tattoos gone mainstream? Is essentially the taboo, I guess, about tattoos, is it gone? 877-301-8970. One of the things I like about Rich Davey, I was sure he was going to dance around that final question. Mm-hmm. Well, it would depend on how qualified the person was. He said, essentially, if all things were equal, and if a potential executive hiree had an exposed tattoo, that it would make it less likely that he would hire him or her. My sense is, while they're clearly becoming much more mainstream, that continues to be the case, at least in certain lines of work. Would you not agree?
I think in certain lines of work, absolutely. And, you know, you certainly, if you're going to have one that shows, then you're in even bigger
trouble.
Well,
I'm only talking about ones that show, really.
But you know, I've said this before. I do yoga, and in the hot yoga classes, it is unbelievable. It's like two-thirds of the kids in there, and they're mostly people in their 20s and 30s. Talk about tattooed. They're up their shoulders. They're up in their neck. They're down their arms. They're all over the place.
Well, sleeves are huge.
And I have,
but they usually end where your shirt would end, so that if you chose to cover it up.
Right. But if you're a woman, you know, a lot of shirts and dresses and blouses do not cover your whole. I mean, they're low cut, obviously, and so they're going to see the tattoos. I'll tell you one thing I've learned.
What's that?
From looking at all these tattoos, it really matters the quality of the tattoo artist, because some of them are great and some of them are horrible.
Incidentally, everybody knows the current day tattooees, for obviously Lena Dunham, the genius behind Girls, Margaret Cho, another genius comedian. She has a garter with a gun on her upper thigh. Everybody's, we talked to Mike Tyson a couple of months ago. We've seen the thing on the face, which doesn't do it for me. My favorite of the currents, Johnny Depp, had a tattoo that said Winona Forever. He was dating Winona Ryder.
That's right.
He had a change to what, Marjorie?
To Wino Forever when they broke up. But here's a good one. Victoria Beckham, she's planning ahead. She's married to David Beckham, the great soccer player, correct?
One of the Spice Girls.
Yeah, so here she's got one that I suppose would fit for if things don't work out between her and David Beckham. Here's her tattoo. I am my love's and my love is mine who browses among the lilies. It's down her spine. So if she gets a new boyfriend, it will work for him as well.
Apparently will. It's a one-size-fits-all. And also, we had Amanda was kind enough, our colleague, to look into history. I was stunned by this. Thomas Edison, tattooed.
Stunned.
Teddy Roosevelt, the most amazing. You and I both agree. Winston Churchill didn't survive.
Barry Goldwater. The conservative.
The Republican nominee for president against Lyndon Johnson in 1964. He had adorned his hand, it says, with a crescent moon and four dots, a trademark of the Smoky People. It's an Arizona organization dedicated to preserving Native American culture. In any case, the numbers are up over 15 years, 50% from 21% to 40%. And just to get you in the mood, I think the most famous tattoo moment in recent state history, actually getting close to 1999, happened during a gubernatorial debate. It involved one of the people who's a regular guest on the show, Shannon O'Brien, running against Mitt Romney. I believe Tim Russert was the MC, the great Tim Russert. Listen to a little piece of history.
And according to the Boston Public Health Commission, she could not get a tattoo. I called Dark Wave Tattoo Parlor, and they said, no tattoos for anyone under 18.
Would you like to see my tattoo?
No, never mind.
Now, Marjorie, if you recall, do you not remember the talk on the street
people
being
people went crazy?
It hurt her. Yeah. I don't know if it cost her the race, but the conventional wisdom at the time was to her. It's 2014. There's admittedly, it may have something to do with gender. Martha Coakley, let's assume she's the nominee of the Democratic Party. If Martha Coakley made the same comment in a debate with one of the independents and Charlie Baker, let's say, I don't know what's happening with Mark Fisher.
Yeah.
I'm serious. 12 years later, would she get away with it where Shannon O'Brien did not?
Well, it's interesting because Martha Coakley is, you view her as a law and order. She's the attorney general, former Middlesex County District Attorney.
Yeah.
If Martha said she had a tattoo, I think it might help her, actually.
Well, there you go. I mean,
depending on where it was.
Despite what Rich Davey said about who he'd hire and who he wouldn't, it is a totally different time. With some industry exceptions and with some placement exceptions, it's just totally mainstream. Let's start with Ryan. You're in Newton. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hey, how you doing?
Excellent.
Good. I have a friend who has a bunch of tattoos all over his, you know, his neck and his arms. And he's one of the hardest working people I've ever met. He works to support his family, his father, his mother, his sister. And he's been working at Babies R Us for a while now with no problem. One of the nicest people you could ever meet. And basically, I just don't think that tattoos should impact how you look to the rest of the world. I don't think that any body modification should impact how professional you look and what kind of a person you
what
are.
What kind of work?
Did
you say what kind of work he does?
Yeah, he works at Babies R Us right now. But before that, he's worked at Walmart, the distribution centers, all over the place.
But Ryan, even if you make the case powerfully that there shouldn't be any bias against somebody with tattoos if they're good at what they do, and it's pretty hard to disagree with that, there is, don't you think, or do you think it's passé?
No,
do you think it's over with?
It completely impacts how people look at you personally, because they think of you as, I don't know, some kind of person or ruffian who just kind of wants to decorate their body and doesn't care about their appearance. But I don't think a lack of caring about your appearance should impact that.
I hear you, and I agree with you. Ryan, thank you kindly for the call. Let's go up to Salem, where Chris is on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Good morning or afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
I just wrapped up a photography project called Bled for Boston, where I photographed almost 100 people from the Boston area and their Boston-themed tattoos that they got after the marathon bombing.
Oh, my. Oh,
you're kidding.
Where does somebody see this, Chris?
Currently, it's on my website, bledforboston.com.
Bledforboston.com. Okay, go ahead.
Right, it was a gallery show at the Boston Center for Adult Education throughout the month of April, and I was expecting, you know, tattooed tough guys, you know, guys from Southie and a lot of shamrocks. And I got nurses, I got police officers, I got moms, I got marathon runners. MBTA officer Dick Donahue participated.
Oh, really? The guy who was shot in Watertown, by the way, and almost lost his life, for those who don't recall. Go ahead.
That's exactly right. And just the, it was all walks of life. And it was a lot of people who had never gotten a tattoo before. A lot of first tattoos and on ankles and wrists and arms. And I was touched and just really impressed with people's dedication to the city and to the marathon and to the victims as well.
Hey, Chris, we're going to check out your website. Thanks so much
thank you for telling
bringing
us
this up to speed.
Know about
it's great.
That.
Nor did
that
I.
Is terrific. We're talking about the increase among Americans, particularly younger Americans, are getting tattoos more than ever, and whether this is going to impact them in their future careers. Of course, it's going to be different, too, because if you're 20 now, you don't think it's a big deal.
58% of millennials are in a household with a tattoo.
You just don't think it's a big deal at all, and it may be people that are 40 and over who are upset about this. Unfortunately, for the 25-year-olds, it's mostly the 40 and overs that are doing the hiring.
I think very few people use your word are upset about it. I think in certain industries, there's a notion, which I think will die eventually, as that caller said a minute ago. I don't know what it is. If you're a banker, if you're a lawyer
in
court, whatever
it is.
So-called
white shoe law firms. Everyone's so dressed up all the time and so fancy, you can have a run in your stocking, never mind a tattoo around your ankle. Let's go to Laura in Brookline. What do you think, Laura?
Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have a tattoo shop in Brookline,
and
I knew when I tattooed a priest that
it was
mainline, and there was absolutely no question about it.
Can we ask you what the priest had tattooed on him?
It was a Native American style of feathers, so it really had nothing to do even with religion. And the funny thing was, he was sitting in here, and I'm tattooing. This was actually 15 years ago, so it's been a while.
Mm-hmm.
He's sitting in here. I'm tattooing him, and a couple of his parishioners came in. And
great.
The funny thing was, they didn't quite know what to do because their priest saw them in a tattoo shop. But, oh, no, their priest was getting a tattoo. So it was just a very strange...
Are you still a tattoo artist, Laura?
I've been tattooing for 21 years.
And you know, we ordinarily don't do this, but since we asked the guy where his exhibit was, what's the name of your shop?
It's Electric Angel Tattoo.
Electric. Before you go away, have you seen the MO of the, or the demographic, I guess is the word I'm looking for, of your average customer changing over those 15 years?
You know, it's all over the place. I've had people in, the oldest was 86. And there's, of course, a big cluster right at 18 when it's legal.
Sure.
And a lot... like a cluster at when people turn the decades, each decade, and now a lot of bucket list people, you know, oh, I want to do this, you know, before I'm too old, before they bury me. And so it's all over.
Laura, the Secretary of Transportation, Rich Davey, was here before. He said there's Azzle over the T for tattoo removal companies. And this is Steve just emailed from Marion saying he'd be wealthy if he could open a chain of tattoo removal kiosks. So do you see a lot of that, the regret, you know, 10 years, 20 years down the line, especially if you put your wife on your shoulder or whatever and she's no longer your wife?
And a lot of my business is also doing cover-ups. So most things you can find a way to work around. Now, some things are more difficult than others, but there's usually a way to puzzle out, you know, a nice way to cover something besides just doing a big black slash.
Okay.
Hey, Laura, thank you, and good luck with your... I love the whole priest thing, and then the parishioners come in, and it's pretty good thing there.
Nicole from Shrewsbury, what do you think about tattoos, Nicole?
Hi. Well, I actually have a tattoo myself that is visible most times. It's on the inside of my forearm, and I suppose you could cover it up with long sleeves, but I'm actually going into the ministry myself, and I think it's a lot less of a stigma with that profession. I think it's more of a generational thing than it is a professional thing, because depending on what it is, and like you were saying before, the quality of the work really depends on. I think people look at the tattoo itself now more than they see, oh, you have a tattoo.
What do you have, Nicole?
Well, the one that's most visible is a scripture verse, but I have other tattoos that are not necessarily religious.
Huh.
But Nicole, the one thing that counters what you say, that it's just generational, not profession, Rich Davey, if you haven't seen him, who the Secretary of Transportation, how old do you think Rich is? 40 years old?
Around that.
40 years. I mean, he's a pretty accomplished guy for 40 years old. But he's a pretty open-minded guy. I know him a little bit. And him saying, without hesitating a minute, that he'd think twice and probably not hire someone with an exposed tattoo, I think speaks to the fact that in a part of the world that isn't ancient, there still is an issue. But, Nicole, thanks for the call. We're going to take one more quick one. Emily, you're in Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Emily.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for
calling.
So I just wanted to say that, you know, as a millennial, I do have about 4 or 5 tattoos. Mine are covered. And in my circle of friends, we call hands and neck tattoos job killers.
Job killers is what you said, right?
Yeah, job killers. Basically, because it's the first thing that you look at when you meet someone.
Right.
So not that I'm anti, you know, having them on my hands or my wrists or my neck, but, you know, I put a lot of thought into where I wanted to get my tattoos, because I knew at some point, okay, I have my whole spine done, so when I get married, you know, those are going to be in those pictures. And sometimes, you know, I don't think people think them through. And it's there forever.
Yeah.
You know? So I just think that it has become such a part of our culture, especially in my generation. I'm 25. And especially down south, I lived in Florida for about 8 months, and everyone there was covered in tattoos. And some of these people were 18 years old. You know what I mean? And so
I thought your next sentence was going to be, and they're all unemployed. Is that what I mean?
Well, they're not all unemployed, but, you know, I work management, and I can cover mine. So,
yeah. Covering, you know, is a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really something, you know, and my parents are older. They had me, you know, when they were older, and my mom cried the first time. My God, how could you do that?
Hey, Emily, that's a great call.
Thank you for the call. I cried, too, let me tell you. I'm with your mother, Emily, on that one. But anyway, up next, has the revenge of the nerds already begun, with the likes of Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg ruling the world? Do we think differently about these guys, or do the smart, obsessive people of the world still get exiled to the island of freaks and geeks? Karen Miller from Innovation Hub joins us next for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH.
So here's the deal. You give us 9.5 years of your life, we'll give you $5 million.
It was unreal. It was like a nightmare to me, you know. It was like a nightmare.
Just kidding. No $5 million.
You have the courts on your side. You have a panel saying he's owed $5 million. And then all of a sudden, it's game over, lights out.
A man wrongfully convicted and the bankrupt city that can't pay up. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7
WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Moo.com, where you can print business cards with the option of a different design on every card in a pack. You can say hello with Moo.com. That's Moo.com. And A24 Films, presenting Lock, starring Tom Hardy as a man with one night to make a life-changing decision with reverberating consequences. He just wants to do the right thing. Now playing in select theaters.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. President Obama has been described as nerd-in-chief. Jimmy Wales, he's the creator of Wikipedia, is another top-tier nerd. And, of course, Gates and Steve Jobs are among the most esteemed nerds in modern history. So is the revenge of the nerds already in full swing? Or do the brainy, mildly obsessive eggheads among us still get ostracized for being smart? And if they do, is that the death knell for our effort to ensure that more people in America get involved in math and science? Here with us to talk about how and why nerds can save the world is Kara Miller. She, of course, is host of the Innovation Hub. Hi there, Kara.
Hi. So let me ask you a question. Were you picked on as a nerd in school, Jim?
I was picked on for other reasons. I was not bullied. I was a little bit. I wasn't really a bookworm, but a little bit.
Okay. Right. Marjorie?
No.
Okay.
Why do you ask?
I'm just interested.
I'm sure you were.
Yeah,
I'm sure. But,
are you trying to say?
Because you're a really well-read. I mean, you're a nerd. I mean, you a nerd?
You know what? I'll tell you, though.
Yes.
I'll tell you what I did do, because they used to track kids when I was in school. And if you got into the smart class, they put you in the smart class. I did everything I could not to hang around with the kids in my classes when I was out of school, because I did not want to be thought of as a nerd. So I would, because in my school, it was miserable to be a nerd.
I was not socially crafty enough at that age to figure out how to split that difference. But I think it's interesting to think about, as you said, President Obama has talked about, you know, STEM jobs, science, mm-hmm. technology, engineering, math. They're really, really important. And yet, I would challenge people listening to think about themselves, their kids. Are nerds still picked on? I mean, you can say to a kid all you want, and I've had like CEOs say this kind of thing to me. You can say to kids all you want in school, you know, math is just as important as football. Math is more important than football. But when the football star has 1,000 people turn out for their game, and the only people who turn out for the math league contest are like the two parents chaperoning it, that says a lot.
Exactly.
Right? Kids are very smart at picking up on what you actually do versus what you say. And so I think in some ways, we do talk about the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Bill Gates, but I don't know that for most kids, that's who they want to be, even though that path is clearly much more lucrative than wanting to be Beyonce.
So if you're right that there still is a stigma, and there's some exceptions. We were talking in the newsroom, and there's some people who have kids in elementary school where the nerds are celebrated. I think they're the outliers. Is your position, or the people with whom you've spoken, is your position that this pejorative nerd thing is an inhibitor in terms of our getting to where we need to get on all this STEM agenda, so to speak? Is that the conventional wisdom?
I think it is. You know, let's go to to pop culture for a second. Let's listen to a clip. This is Big Bang 3 from the Big Bang, consistently one of the most popular shows on television. Now, it is about nerds, but let's listen to how the nerds are portrayed.
There are 8 other campsites nearby, mostly science nerds like us. But just over yon ridge are 2 not unattractive middle school teachers who reek of desperation.
And okay, and one more for you. This is from Portlandia, which you
may
have seen
before. One of
the
funniest shows.
Right.
Fred Armisen, one of the funniest shows in the history of television.
This is a nerd public service announcement, and it sort of lays down what in America today we think nerds are.
I'm an actual nerd. I wear these glasses to see. I watch Star Trek, TNG. I play Skyrim. I'm shy. I'm not wearing a nerd costume for Halloween. This is how I actually dress. And when I take these glasses off, I'm not suddenly revealed to be sexy or cool. I'm still a nerd.
So, I mean, in some ways, we still talk about nerds as these sexually very unappealing, right? We put them over in this category of, well, you know, they may make money, but they're not. There are other people who make money. I mean, the people in the NFL make money, and they're much more like the people you'd want to be, popular people.
Now, let me ask you a question. Does it matter where you grow up? Because I think it's easier to be a nerd in a place like Brookline or Newton than it is to be in a tough urban school system where the nerds are just brutalized. They don't even have a chance.
Oh, totally. Okay. So I talked to this guy named David Andrig, who teaches at Bennington College and wrote the book on nerds. Literally, it's called Nerds. And
Nerds.
And he said that, you know, sometimes when he talks to people in Boston or Silicon Valley and they say, well, I think things are getting better. Things are better than when I was a kid. They are in these school systems, the Brooklines. They are in places where the parents work for tech companies or they are lawyers and doctors, and they are very good at transmitting to their kids how important it is to work hard and how much it pays off, right? Yep. The kids see it themselves. They understand that this is like the road to prosperity and that it isn't, you know, getting to the NBA. That, like, that's not going to happen. But he said, you know, for the vast majority of kids, it is still much, much more desirable to be like the athletic star, and it is very undesirable to be good in math. So I definitely think it matters where you live.
Is somebody working to change your perception? When Marjorie was asking the question a second ago, does it matter where you go to school? I thought you were talking about in the world. You made a good point. But in China, for example, just as a good example, surely nerds are kings. I mean, it clearly, the more you study, the more studious you are, the smarter, more accomplished you are in school, the more you're respected. So is we're laughing at this, but is there a campaign to decriminalize nerddom, to destigmatize nerddom?
Because
but it really is. I mean, it is a problem. If you want kids to take math and science more seriously, because those are the two areas where I believe we're falling behind the rest of the world, then you have to convince them that you're going to be celebrated. Maybe you're not going to be like the quarter star quarterback of the team, but you're not going to be like made to sit in the part of the cafeteria by yourself.
Well, let me say two things. One about China, which is true of some other countries. We come out of this, some of the way we treat nerds, I think, is our history. So we come out of a sort of celebrating cowboys, celebrating rugged individualism, frontier. Like, the American myth is the person on the frontier,
right,
which is a strong person rather than a brainy person necessarily, because that's what you need to survive. Well, in China, they come out of a history of, if you wanted to get, this is a very old tradition, if you wanted to get out of the village, out of a very rural village, and go to a big city, you had to be the smartest person in that village, and only then did you have any chance of success. So those people would be revered. I remember my mom going to China and saying, they had a statue of like a kid who was like the smartest kid in 20 years.
Is that really true?
Yeah, in a village who had gotten, you know, who had just like been the best in the whole province, and they like made a statue to him. So I definitely think that just because this is true in America doesn't mean it's true everywhere. Although I have to say, the author David Andrig did say that if we're interested in trying to keep other countries from catching up to the U.S., you know, syndicate the Big Bang Theory more. And then that way, you know, nerds will be stigmatized everywhere, and that'll sort of keep
But there's another thing on the ground level. We discussed this on our former show. One of the, I saw it, abominations, and maybe it's too strong a word, one of the N towns, I can never remember which N it is, in Metro West, got rid of the honor roll a number of years ago because they said it made people who didn't make the honor roll feel bad. One of the most preposterous things I've ever heard. And what I asked on that show, I remember to this day, are they going to not broadcast the scores of the football games too? Because the losing teams are going to be upset. So you celebrate in that school, and maybe I'm making too big a thing, you celebrate the winning football team, but you don't celebrate the winning students. You don't say, we're going to recognize the 10% of the class who did better than the other 9, which doesn't mean they're bad people. It means they were the most accomplished in the classroom. I mean, there's got to be some level of advanced recognition to undercut this whole thing.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we're very into competition in this country, but it tends to be around American Idol, March Madness. I mean, you think about the things that people really care about.
Or how rich you are.
How rich you are. Now, Are there efforts to say, look, that the kids who are smart are you know, the kids you should really look up to? Of course. Dean Kamen has FIRST Robotics. There's the Intel Science Competition, which used to be the Westinghouse Science Competition. Are these things making any real inroads, I don't know, against, you know, March Madness and America's Next Top Model? I don't really know.
It's tough.
And I think a lot of it has to be parents and teachers, because it's very hard to control what kind of media is out there. I think a lot of it has to be parents and teachers saying, you know, it may be true that kids are all trying to get into the NFL or the NBA, but that's not going to happen for those kids. If you really want to be successful, here's the road to that. Here's, you know, how you do it.
Listen to this email from Katie. This is great. We are a middle-aged couple and have been looking at properties in Cambridge and Somerville. Repeatedly, we've been beaten in bidding wars by nerdy guys who look like they're about 14, and they do gloat a bit, and I don't dare tell my cute, popular, unemployed 20-something kids.
You know, by the way, on this note, Amanda, one of our colleagues, just sent us a note saying her high school, this is, I laugh when I read it, but it's exactly what needs to happen. Her high school had a pep rally to celebrate standardized testing. Now, while I'm not crazy about standardized testing, let's put that aside. It's Coventry High School in Coventry, Connecticut. Now, we're all laughing at that. That is exactly the kind of recognition that academic achievement, maybe not standardized testing, some sort of academic achievement needs, no?
Yeah, and I think once you can sort of get beyond that gauntlet of school, a lot of people celebrate nerdiness. I mean, you get jobs and you're asked to do things, and you're 14 and you can afford a place in Cambridge. I mean, there's a lot of rewards. But the trouble is, so many kids, I think, are kept from realizing their full potential, because I remember girls in my high school, even though they were smart, really smart, and you knew they were doing well, not wanting to be the people who raised their hand because they didn't want to be, right?
Exactly.
They didn't want to be the people who were recognized as knowing something. They just wanted to secretly know it and then sort of go off.
And get a date with a non-nerdy guy.
You got it.
Exactly.
So what is this? What's this guy's name who wrote the book, Nerds?
David Anderegg.
What does Anderegg think is the solution to this, or the fix for the nerd crisis, for lack of a better expression?
I think some of it is celebrating nerds, celebrating intelligence. I mean, Amanda mentioned it with her high school. We talked about it with China. But you can do a lot of things. I went with my toddler to the playground the other week, and there was this woman, very attractive, with her little child, and she was pushing her on the swing, and I looked at her t-shirt and it said, "Math is radical," and it had a radical sign. And I said, "I really like your t-shirt." And she was like, "I've gotten a lot of compliments on this."
Good for her.
And I think some of it is as little as that. Just having things in the world, kids have to have people to look up to. I mean, that's why they look up to Beyonce or whatever.
Yeah.
They have to have people to look up to. And if it's not going to be famous people, it's got to be people around them. It's got to be people who come in for career day, all that kind of stuff.
Isn't there a gender thing here, too? I think it's much harder for boys to be nerds. Girls can be secret nerds, you know what I mean? More easily, I think, than boys, you know, because the boys.
You mean you're talking about young? You're talking about boys?
Yes. Well, you look at Mark Zuckerberg, he looks nerdy. I never thought Steve Jobs looked that nerdy, actually. Bill Gates, I mean,
the
nerd
city.
The nerd of all. You know what I mean? And girls can kind of hide it better.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think you're right, but I think that has ups and downs.
Yeah.
I think in some ways that encourages girls. It encourages girls to be really passive people, to be smart, but never sort of get out there.
Yeah.
And I think that leads to the whole Sheryl Sandberg lean in. They've taught themselves for so long to just be smart and take a back seat that they never get in the front seat. Whereas, yes, maybe Bill Gates is teased, but he is like, let's say he's proudly nerdy and he just sticks with it. And after a while, that pays off. So I know what you mean about boys and girls, but I think there's upsides and downsides. So I don't know that I would say it's easier for one or the other.
You know, one last thing about this. I mean, seriously, because Gates not only looks like a nerd, but is the wealthiest nerd and not the wealthiest. He should do, I mean, he funds a huge amount of education initiatives around the country and the world. He should do, I'm serious,
the
PSAs with himself.
Yeah.
Does he have a sense of humor? I have no idea.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
I'm serious. If he made fun of himself a little bit, but talked into the camera about essentially the importance of getting rid of the stigma and so that maybe you're not going to be a billionaire, but you have a far better chance of success, as you say, than if you're worried about whether or not you're going to play in the NBA.
That's a really good idea. You know, the it gets better thing about being gay.
Yeah.
I think like Stephen Colbert could start this. He's really nerdy and he's successful.
He's totally nerdy.
And, you know, I think we can all say proudly now that we've grown up. I mean, I'm a nerd, so, and I'm out there.
You're doing relatively well.
Speaking of relatively well,
what are you doing on that relatively terrific radio show?
Tonight we are talking to Tom Friedman, who probably would say he's
another nerd. He's a nerd.
And then this weekend, Saturday morning at 10, we're talking to David Andrig about nerds.
Two nerds.
You know.
I can't wait.
It's Nerd Week on Innovation Hub.
He's the host of the Innovation Hub. Are you a nerd or not a nerd? Do you identify as a nerd there, Jim Browder?
Nerdish.
Nerdish, okay. Karen Miller, Innovation Hub. Up next, Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam joins us for Open Mic. That is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
EdX President Anant Agarwal continues to believe that online learning is a rising tide that will lift all boats.
So it'll absolutely enhance the brands of
on-campus
universities.
The WGBH News Higher Ed Desk on WGBH Radio.
Because 7 out of every $10 spent on daily operations here at 89.7 is provided by listeners, this program is being enjoyed by millions of New Englanders and many more online. Thanks so much.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and HBX, the online learning initiative powered by Harvard Business School faculty for college sophomores, juniors, and seniors who want to learn the language of business. Accepting applications for June at hbx.hbs.edu. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, bringing diverse people to Boston. The series returns to Symphony Hall next season with Dan Rather, Madeline Albright, Ken Burns, and others. BostonSpeakerSeries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browder and Marjorie Eaton. Joining us as he does every Thursday for Open Mic is Alec Beam. Alec. We call him Alex, too. And as Marjorie, we don't know him that well. And as Marjorie and I do every time he's here, we marvel at how appropriate it is that he's named Alex. Because Marjorie said this morning. When Alex writes a column, it's like Sir Alex Ferguson on the soccer field. He always scores that winning goal. Remember when you said that, Marjorie? Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe, even though he said in a New York Times column a week ago that he didn't work for the Globe. We'll get to that in a minute. I don't quite get it.
Yeah,
his new book is
American
Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Hello there, Alex.
Hi,
Jim,
Alex.
Marjorie, it's great to be here.
It's
how do you do?
Always great to be here. So you have many obsessions, I suspect, Alex. But we're going to start with a couple of them. It seems like you have a big thing, a semi-obsession with David Barron. He's a Harvard law professor. His nomination to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit is sort of hanging in the balance down in Washington, D.C. because of some drone strikes. Now, what is going on with you and Mr. Barron or Professor Barron, please?
Okay. I have a deep prejudice here that dates back several years. And this whole story sort of – it was broken by Charlie Savage, who won a Pulitzer Prize at the Boston Globe for his work on George Bush's signing statements. He went to the New York Times to cover the Department of Justice, and he broke the story that that Barron and Marty somebody, whose name escapes me, co-authored a memo at the Department of Justice.
Marty Lederman.
Thank you, of Georgetown University. Co-authored a memo for the notorious Office of Legal Counsel at the DOJ, and I'll get back to that in a second. Authorizing, it was exactly like, in my opinion, what was going on in the Bush administration, except this was the Obama administration. They were looking for a covering, you know, legal cover, so they could go kill this incredibly bad guy who has a complicated name, like Anwar al-Awlaki.
Yes.
An American
citizen.
Who was working with al-Qaeda.
Right. So they were – I mean, I am really cynical and dark, and I am obsessed about this. I was the first Globe writer ever to write about this when Julia Kayyem, Mrs. David Barron, was actually in the building. And believe me, I went to tremendous lengths to avoid speaking to her.
She's running for governor. We'll get to her in a minute for those who are not familiar
I speak solely from prejudice. I phoned, by the way, both Barron and Marty – And they were very polite, and they refused to talk to me. But it was Charlie Savage's scoop. My deep-seated prejudice here is sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander. These Bush guys were unbelievable. From the Office of Legal Counsel, you know, the Bush-Cheney terror apparat, paid a high price, in my opinion, for writing memos like these. The notorious torture memo, for instance, possibly written by John Yoo and possibly with a co-author, Goldsmith. In any case, I felt this was insane hypocrisy that John Yoo, whom I don't know personally, but I do know, literally had to go into hiding when he left the George Bush administration. He was at Whitman Law School, and I was in touch with him. Said, "I bet you're hiding there," and he denied it. But in fact, at Berkeley, he's actually a fairly prestigious professor at Bolt Hall, which is University of California Berkeley's law school. They were trying to strip him of his tenure.
So here's what Alex wrote actually in 2011. He wrote, "So if Yoo is a war criminal, then please explain the status of Harvard Law School Professor David Barron and Georgetown University Law Professor Lederman." So your position was liberals were two-faced. They were hypocrites. While they were trashing you for the torture memo, they were not trashing, let's focus on Barron for the moment, for the drone memo. But you are aware, and by the way, that is what's holding up his nomination. It's not clear to me whether it's the issue of whether the Obama administration will release the drone memo to the public, would that be enough, or if it's the underlying thing. And obviously, it's an odd mix of liberals and Rand Paul,
which is always interesting.
And the ACLU is deep into it.
But you should know, while the Civil Liberties Union, I assume, was one of your targets, as was public radio, by the way, in your column, I should just note,
a surprise.
In 2011, the Civil Liberties Union is opposing the nomination of Barron. Are you aware of that?
Of course I'm aware of it.
Okay, fine. So, I mean, they're not hypocritical here, are they? Liberals were upset with John Yoo, and the Civil Liberties Union is not happy with David Barron. Where's the hypocrisy?
My beef is basically with the media. The media has been silent, I would argue, up until now. I mean, I had a friend.
Well, also academia. If the University of Berkeley is trying to get rid of you, why is Harvard Law School not?
Barron is like a god over at Harvard Law School. He did a huge project for Drew Faust, blah, blah. I bet he's a good guy. I mean, let's not get into the holes in my argument because
we only have a 2-hour show.
That would ruin it, yeah, I guess.
I'm not sure I'm entirely finished raving on this subject.
Oh, sure.
As I pointed out in that column, you know, I'm in a complicated position because I approve of killing bad guys. I always have. I thought Bush and Cheney were on the right track. Kill the bad guys. Torture them. I don't have a problem with that. But I really... It disgusts me. Jane Mayer is like a friend of mine. Jane Mayer got rich, you know, accusing Cheney and his dark shadow wedding, Eddington, whatever his name is, you know, of all this malfeasance. They tortured people in Poland, blah, blah, blah. I'm just saying, New Yorker, where's your big takeout on David Barron? Where's your big takeout on renditions under the Obama administration? I really do feel strongly about this. I think this is two-faced media hypocrisy BS.
Okay, I think we have heard a lot of media discussion, though, of the drone strikes in general. I mean, there's been a lot of opposition to that. And I think some people would see that
differently. He doesn't want you to spend time putting holes in his argument. But go ahead, Marjorie.
I think it's not unreasonable to see a drone strike which kills somebody, let's hope, outright with waterboarding. I think some people would see that differently.
They might. I don't.
Death as opposed to torture.
Yes.
Well, I don't really have a problem with drone strikes, although I feel that...
On American citizens, even if it turns out they're allied with the
enemy? I feel that's what people haven't debated about the Barron Marty memo, is this notion that you can kill an American citizen. I mean, that's a super big deal. That should go by the Supreme Court at the very least.
Where are you on this with Juliette Kyan, who's running for governor?
I've never met her.
Okay, but you're not casting any aspersions on her candidacy?
Not at all. In fact, you know, she was a Pulitzer finalist as a Globe. Globe column. Surprisingly, she didn't write about this issue, eyeball roll. But
I mentioned David Bernstein, who's our colleague here, wrote a piece in Boston Magazine saying that while it is true, Juliette Kyan has nothing to do with this, in light of the fact that her key credential is Homeland Security, on which she is seen by some liberals as a little too hawkish, that unfairly or otherwise she may be tarnished at the convention where she needs 15% in June by liberals, again, because their attitude is you visit the sin of the husband unfairly on the wife. You have no problem with that?
Well, no. I mean, I have no problem with what Bernstein wrote.
Oh,
no,
fine.
I disagree with that. I want to put a torpedo right amidship my jive argument. The fact is, I mean, but and again, it kind of speaks to what irks me. Naturally, the and the Goldsmith torture memos were leaked immediately, essentially by the liberal DOJ apparat or somebody mm-hmm. who's in bed with the media. The big hole in my argument here is that we haven't seen the 60-page memo, the Barron memo. So it's kind
of, well, it's not a hole in your argument, because if it turns out there is nothing that should be troubling, then the Obama administration, for starters, should at least release it to members of the Senate. And secondly, as this guy Udall, a Democrat, has said, I don't want it delivered in the Senate secretly. I want it released to the public, or I am not voting in favor of Barron's nomination. That's
still
a Democrat.
I still think in what purports to be an intellectual argument, it's a big to discuss something that you don't know what it is. I mean, you know, maybe they said it's a really bad idea to kill this American citizen and we're changing the Constitution in a bad way.
Well, there's a hole in the argument that I'm really fascinated by, and I want to know, when Juliet Kime was a columnist at the Boston Globe, you, of course, were a columnist at the Boston Globe, when you had to walk by her desk, I mean, did you go backwards down Morrissey Boulevard? Did you go to the parking lot to avoid her? How did you handle those?
I never introduced myself. I heard
so
all...
So you hope she'd not know who you are.
Well, right. Also, my column was buried in the back of the Jeep. Section. Okay. I mean, I assume no
you
one
know what the
read
beauty
it.
Is, compared to Globe columnists, even though he doesn't work for the Globe, apparently, right. Alex Beam, mm-hmm. who hides out from Juliet Kayyem when he criticizes her and her husband, Dan Shaughnessy trashes players. And what does he do the next day? He goes right back in the locker room and confronts the players. What's
he's
the matter
a man,
with you?
He's a man's man.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Can we talk about, speaking of the New York Times, here's the line.
I haven't even stupider. I was actually at a party with them.
Yeah.
And I asked
with
my
Kayyem and Barron? And what happened?
I asked my wife, I said, do you think David Barron has a sense of humor? Could I go up and tap him on the shoulder and said, I'd prefer you were in jail rather than...
I think he'd love that.
My wife said, you know, Alex, I wouldn't really take that risk.
I think it's probably a good point.
Yeah.
Now, you wrote a piece in the New York Times, of all places, on April 29th. Now, the line that stuck with me is, for the record, I no longer work at the Globe. I know, technically...
That was a year ago.
Whatever. So what? Oh, that was in
Duh.
Between.
Yes,
oh, okay, then
yes.
fine. Then
okay.
I take it back. Good. But your whole point, confessions of a word snob. I mean... For you, of all people, to write a piece trashing other famous authors for using words that mere mortals don't understand.
Whom did I
talk about?
Trash? What are you talking
about? Nabokov or something? Who did you?
Or Nabokov, as he sometimes.
Oh, is that how he's referred to? My apologies.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you,
I didn't trash him. I praised him.
I was unable to prepare for today's show because I had to spend an hour and a half looking up like 75 words.
Oh, stop!
I mean, fritillary.
Fritillary.
Fritillary. Yeah. Chamfrain. How do you?
I have no idea what any of those words.
Okay. Well, these are the.
What was your point in that piece, by the way? Was there a point there?
It was actually about my love for words. It was the thing at the end. I actually declared that there are some words I'm openly in love with. Also, it's all about my bizarre anger, repression, and vengeance. I wanted to fire this torpedo across Marty Barron, not David Barron. Marty
Your
Barron's
old boss.
Yeah, because he spiked my gyro ball column.
To explain what gyro ball is,
that really bleeped me off.
Okay, what is gyro ball?
Well, it's definitely explained in this.
Well, most people don't have it in their hand.
It's a sort of pitch.
It's what Daisuke
Matsuzaka.
Yeah,
I'll explain it, all right.
Yeah,
explain it. Fine. Daisuke Matsuzaka came to the Boston Red Sox with all this fanfare and hyperbole maybe around 2007. And a huge story trailing him from Japan was that he threw a gyro ball. And there's almost an equivalent in English, and I'm blanking on it. But it was this famous pitch that went everywhere. It's a little bit like the Ephus pitch. I think Bill Lee used to throw an Ephus pitch. But in any case, a wacky, wacky curveball. And Marty Barron, man, he's such a serious guy. The editor of the Boston Globe, he literally sent out a memo saying, no one in this paper, sports writer or anyone, can refer to the term gyro ball. And then he appended some scientific
To prove that it may not really exist? Was that his argument?
I don't know. I thought we're supposed to be having fun at the newspaper. I mean, the gyro ball, how could you not write about it? It had a life of its own. It wandered all over the strike
Your
zone.
Your boss said don't use that word, and then you proceeded to write an entire column about that word?
I'm sorry. Is there an issue there?
Okay. And by the way, he really suffered as a result of it, and he's now editor of the Washington Post.
Yeah. I bet gyro ball is also off the table.
The reason I mistakenly assumed your column for the New York Times was in 2014 rather than 2013 is it came on right around the time that is it the Washington Post, speaking of Marty Barron, is putting out an edict about words that one should not use when one works for the newspaper?
Their Outlook section actually has gotten a fair amount of sort of internet traction. They put that out over a year ago. They keep a running tab of dubious cliches that they'd prefer to
keep. Like what, for example?
And I've used them all.
Do you know any of them?
I've used them all.
Should we say what a few of them are?
Yes.
Okay, well, you're not supposed to use words like deep-pocketed.
Deep-pocketed.
That's the New York Times, by the way.
Oh, is that the New York Times?
Yeah.
Words like narrative,
rare
fussy. Window, watering hole. I hate watering hole.
I love watering hole.
I love watering hole,
I hate
too.
It. It's so overused.
Underscores. What's wrong with underscores? Yeah. I've used that a zillion times.
You know, I actually brought two examples from today's Boston Globe.
Oh, good.
There's a spasm of violence. I think, I mean, that's arguably a pretty tired cliche. But even better, they actually... They have a picture of these really cool water bottles with really cool patterns, and they say each bottle has a unique pattern. Now, that should never have gotten past the copy desk.
Oh, each bottle has a unique pattern. That's
one
a very
a
good one.
Yeah, unique should not be misused.
Unique is always misused. People say it all the time. It's one of my bugaboos. So unique.
Very unique.
Yeah, people misuse it all the time. You know where they misuse it? On television, people that are reading the news.
Yes, no, it's.
Can I make a column suggestion to
yes.
you? Who's the guy who writes all those funny? Well, I don't think they're that funny, but funny kind of songs. Who once did a song that was 100% every word was a palindrome? What's that guy's name?
Weird Al
Yankovic. That's exactly who it is. He did a song where every single word was a palindrome.
Can you sing a verse?
You should You should write a column. Where every single word, other than I know you have to use the and that, yeah. Where every single word is a word that has had a taboo visited on it by the Washington Post, mm-hmm. the New York Times. What do you think of that idea? Is that
it's
excellent?
Not that bad. Although in that column, I did the whole first paragraph. That would be fine. A friend of mine named Steve Greenlee actually sort of wrote a column like that, where he had newspaper cliche after newspaper cliche.
And you have
no one would notice, of course.
Here's the sentence, by the way, that he wrote, just so you said the 2013 column. The list provides a rare window into the little noticed world of the editorial zeitgeist of that iconic newspaper. This is Alex writing the time. He says, yes, almost every phrase in that previous sentence appears on the Washington Post's no fly list. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
Including no fly list, I believe.
No fly list. That's another one. That's right. These are the words that you say that you're in love with, and I'm glad the relationship has been good for you, Alex. You say jejun, is that how you pronounce it?
I have no idea.
Refractory
and
nugatory.
Those are great words. Yeah. I found refractory in my book, by the way. I was reading from my book and I had the word refractory, which I love. It's just a great word. It means something or other. I don't know. It means, anyway.
Nugatory?
Everyone thinks nugatory is like Shap of the Three Stooges giving noogie.
It's like a negative. It's like a no. Isn't it mean
inconsequential?
Like
I looked it up.
I think it's a synonym with jejun. Virtual synonym.
Speaking of readings,
dull. How that's dull.
I find it. I think it's great. And by the way, your book is terrific. I think American Crucifixion. But you don't seem like the kind of person who would be comfortable going to a bookstore, which I know you're doing, out on tour. And I know you do this. Doing a reading, answering questions. Are you? What is that like?
Why do
for you
say that?
Well, I'm asking. Well,
I feel in my deepest soul that I actually live for that. That's the genuine vanity of writing. You have to ask yourself, in a way, you live to be able to stand in front of people.
Because that's your audience. You're saying essentially your audience coming to you. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I did a reading just. I like it. In fact, you've touched on another one of my bizarre obsessions.
What's that?
Authors who don't read at readings. I have a close friend. I'm not going to mention him on the air because. He gives these readings.
David Baron, go ahead.
He gives these readings, and he feels like he's like so famous. He goes like, "Well, I'm not going to be reading from my book. I'm just going to tell you about all my important friends and what they think." And that's a scandal. And I'm going to give you a specific example at Brookline Booksmith. For some reason,
they
went
great author readings.
I went downstairs. There's a guy named Jonathan Dee reading from his novel Dee. The guy was such an amazing writer. I bought the book right there. However, just for your listeners, Jonathan Dee's Palladio is the novel they really should read. It's three novels back. This guy's a great writer. I mean, to me, it's all about, in fact, I think it's suspicious authors who don't read at readings. Give me a break. What do you mean? Maybe you can't write.
Why would you not tell us who this person is? Because now you've sort of whet everybody's appetite.
Probably one of his good friends. You know, it occurred to me
right,
that you have a thing going on with Marty Baron, former editor of The Globe, David Baron, Harvard Law School professor. I know they're spelled differently, but do you think
good
there
question.
Could be a link there?
No.
No, okay. No. Just checking.
Alex, speaking of columns, you wrote one this morning. What exactly was the point of this?
It's about to get paid, I think, was the point.
It's about luck. What was the point of this column exactly?
Wait a minute.
I got it. It's organizing your luck life.
Yeah, no, it came. Now I can use actual names. This was in the Globe cafeteria like 4 years ago. Larry Harmon is an editorial writer, came to me, and he said there was a big casino executive just talking to the executive, the editorial board of Boston Globe. And he offered this point, this interesting point that the Chinese, of course, are huge gamblers. They're in a lot of casinos, and apparently, if it was like this Dagwood moment, you know, if this guy, indeed, I was criticized for using a stereotype. Okay, fine, but as it was explained to me, if the Chinese man comes home and he's lost all the entire family fortune, his wife doesn't say, you know, doesn't hit him on the head with a rolling pin. She says, "Oh, bad luck management. You should have arranged the luck better." And then I go on and I actually steal from a piece my son wrote out of Beijing. My son wrote
That's
a
great.
Piece. Yeah, exactly.
Plagiarizing
no one
your son.
Is safe. I know. I think there might be an exception.
I think there is. Yeah.
Yeah.
He actually mentioned that he did a piece about, interestingly, in China, URL addresses are often just numbers. And people's Twitter handles and stuff are often just numbers because they want to get
Lucky numbers.
Yeah, they want to get four in there a lot. And it was in his piece actually that from which I stole that thing about the airline. Although he didn't do his research because I learned that this was a bad luck airline that had a hijacking in 2003. They changed their 800 number, if you will, to all eights, four eights,
ten eights, yeah.
And Sichuan Airlines, if you're feeling lucky, you may want to fly them. But in any case, they haven't had an incident of any kind since they got this new phone number.
Yeah, Alex,
if that's not dispositive, what is?
I think it is.
You mentioned in this column that you begin every month, year, decade, and millennium by reciting the words rabbit, rabbit.
I do. Is there anything strange about that? I also send an email to my sons urging them to begin. But the key
What is rabbit, rabbit, please?
I Googled it. I couldn't find an explanation. It's too super. My mom taught it to me. It's when you wake up the first day of every month, you should say rabbit, rabbit, and that will augur well.
Wait a second. You're looking at Alex Beam as if he is crazy for doing this. Marjorie, you told me about 10 years ago. If something happens, you go back in the house and you sit in the chair or something. What is that? I just realized. What is it you do again?
If I forget something, well, that's because my
just
mother
tell
did
us.
It,
okay,
and I feel
fine.
As though I have to keep
what
doing
it. What is it?
Well, if I forget something, I go back in the house and get it. But before I leave, I have to sit down in a chair and bless myself.
What do you think of that?
I think that's great. I think that's absolutely great.
I mean, really.
The Russians, by the way, the Russians say you should sit down, you know, before leaving the house.
Yeah, well, there you go.
But they don't
bless themselves.
It's
any weirder than rabbit, rabbit, frankly. At least I know what it came from. Did your mother say rabbit, rabbit?
My mother told me to say rabbit, rabbit. And the key, of course, was the millennium. And I think I did say rabbit, rabbit on the first day of the millennium.
Thank God.
All right, that time has come again. About 5 or 6 weeks ago, not for you to leave yet. Five or six weeks ago, we started these 45-second explainers where Alex takes a rather arcane topic and explains it. It attempts to explain it in 45 seconds or less. This one is not – well, actually, it's something that a lot of people have thought about. It's not quite as – I don't know what it is. You just listen. Here's the question, Alex, for you. How do you make money selling tacos or burritos for $4.75 or less? You ready for this?
I am ready for
this. Okay, so here's the deal. We set the clock. You can start in 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay, I emailed your producer saying I wasn't actually prepared to do this explainer.
But
I feel once you're committed to radio, you've got to go for it.
Go ahead.
I did, quote-unquote, reach out, a word which is on my personal no-fly
list. Hate that word.
I reached out to Adam Liebman, a friend of mine and a co-founder of The Wrap, which later became Boloco, I happen to like him because I used to have this guest card.
They have the mini ones, too. They're excellent. Love
those. They're unbelievable.
Go ahead.
He didn't get back to me, so I have to wing it. I did learn. There's several ways. And I'm going to end this with a dramatic.
You haven't started.
I'm going to end this with a philippic against the minimum wage law.
Okay,
well,
philippic.
Okay.
Philippic, indeed. But one way is you can always sort of upgrade. You can do organic tacos. You can claim that all this junk you put in them is organic. Blah 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 blah. But the other, I mean, the key. It's clear you can use the worst possible. You can lose like ground up dog meat and stuff.
Oh.
That's not a problem. However, it occurred to me that. Raising the your labor is practically your key economic factor in keeping taco costs down.
Yeah.
So if we raise the minimum wage, think of the disastrous.
The end of the $4.75 taco.
It's the Anna's Taqueria, Boca Grande. You can kiss them goodbye.
Okay,
I do
fine.
Love
that
Anna's
was really,
Taqueria.
That was excellent.
Okay,
thank
Alex,
you so much.
I really have no idea.
Keep the minimum wage down. That's
the basic message. Keep the working man down.
And he's pro torture too.
Oh my God, where does it stop?
Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe. His new book American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith, and The Fate of the Mormon Church. Alex, so great to see you.
By the way, do you know where you're going to be? What media outlet you'll be appearing on at 6 o'clock tonight?
Do you know what? I'm going to be in a nationally recognized television show.
What would that be?
It's called Broadside. It's on NECN. It has unbelievable penetration.
Broadside, the news
all
with Jim Rowdy with Alex Beam.
This is a huge show, by the way.
Oh, my God. We'll all be tuning in.
We're going to move some units.
We're looking.
Thanks, Alex, for being here, and thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Emily's List and our Friday news quiz with two beer aficionados challenging each other over the week's news. To hear our podcast, or to read more on what we talked about today, go to our website, wgbhnews.org/BPR. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in, and please tune in again tomorrow.